Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It is indeed that time of the week. So, coronavirus update. Marcus, what's going on in the rest of the world?
Yeah, so I want to start with a few numbers. So obviously, just to recap, if you've been in a cave, we have this virus that emerged in Chinese city of Wuhan in December. It is part of a family of viruses called coronaviruses, I guess, and belongs to the same family that gave us SARS and MERS and a few others a decade or more ago. It causes a respiratory illness called COVID-19, and that can spread from person to person. So as of March 2nd, and I just looked at my date, so it's 2 days ago, worldwide infections topped 90,000. About 3,000 people have died since the outbreak began, and the vast majority of cases, more than 80,000, have occurred in China, but now about 60 other countries are also dealing with this outbreak. Nations are preparing for a global pandemic, although it hasn't been declared yet. Nations are getting ready.
Can you just explain, I suppose, the difference? Where do we get to pandemic? Like, what's the point where it crosses over?
I think if a large proportion of the countries in the world are affected by this illness, then yes, I think the World Health Organization just declares it to be so. Yeah.
Okay.
So, it's not a hard line once you get past it, but, it's moving that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the latest outbreaks in South Korea, Italy and Iran are the biggest outside of China. So the maybe slightly more positive news is that in China, the hospitals that were overflowing with COVID-19 patients a few weeks ago have now got empty beds. And trials of drugs that they're trying to experiment with to cure COVID-19 are struggling to get patients because the number of cases reported each day has plummeted.
So this is only in China?
This is in China,
and
yeah.
What's happened is that basically the word is being peaked, right, in terms of
It looks like it's peaked, or it peaked several weeks ago. So there's a WHO, World Health Organization, report which says this is unequivocal, and the sort of the approaches that China has used to contain the spread of the pathogen has actually worked. This is a real effect. This isn't just China reporting that it's working. The question is now whether we can the rest of the world can do what China has done and sort of try and get a handle on this.
So do we know what it is that exactly got them there? Is it the trial vaccines or?
It is partly the nature of China that it was able to take this sort of very aggressive response. Obviously, China is not a democracy. There are certainly human rights issues at stake here. And the response that China used, enforcing curfews, making people stay in the home, restricting travel, things like that, are not really things that most Western-style democracies can actually do, and nor really should they, perhaps.
Would it be a thing that... I mean, what we're dealing with, though, is a sort of crisis. So what they did and what you're saying is that it actually contributed to a total decline.
It did.
In the spread. So in that case, it's been very positive, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people in China didn't get the illness because of their response. Now, there is uncertainty because, China's economy has suffered greatly because of this. Basically, workers shut down in large parts of the country.
Yeah.
And so there is uncertainty about what's going to happen when China sort of restarts things. Will the virus just resurface and get another outbreak? This is coming at a sort of a critical time when like we said, scientists are working out, are we getting a pandemic or not? Or is it being contained? WHO group of scientists that actually traveled to China and observed what was going on there and have written the report. They were also able to review a large data set, a really big data set that Chinese scientists have compiled because it's had the vast majority of the cases. And there's some interesting results. So they've about 80% of the infected people had mild to moderate disease. About 14% had quite severe symptoms, and only about 6% had life-threatening episodes of respiratory failure, septic shock, or organ failure. The fatality rate, maybe not surprisingly, was highest for people over 80. Mm. That's about 22% fatality rate. And for people who had heart disease, diabetes, or hypertension, the fever and dry cough are the most common symptoms. And surprisingly, only about 5% of infected people had runny noses. Okay. So it's the dry cough coupled with the fever you've got to look out for. Children made up only 2.5% roughly of the cases, and almost none of the children were severely ill. For mild and moderate cases, it took about 2 weeks on average, roughly 2 weeks to recover. So hence the sort of the 2-week quarantine.
Mm. Okay.
There is uncertainty still about how many mild, very mild cases occurred, because there is... we're reporting fatality rates, but that's only the case on the cases that were reported. You could actually have COVID-19 and only be sort of suffering mildly or even not at all, and therefore those cases are not reported, and so the actual fatality rates may be artificially higher than in reality. Mm. Yeah.
I do have a question in terms of what they've done in terms of kind of shutting down or trying to limit contact, right, in order to limit the spread. How is it simply that once you have that 2-week window, it kind of, you know, things would not spread anymore, or is it going to pop up again somewhere else? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. Well, that's the big question, and when China reverses the measures it has taken, it might very well pop up again.
Right.
And it rolled out probably the most ambitious and aggressive disease containment effort ever in history. The most sort of controversial measure was the complete lockdown of Wuhan and nearby cities in Hubei province, which put 50 million people under mandatory quarantine since right. the 23rd of January. And that's prevented exportation of the infected people. People aren't, you know, spreading it outside of that region. And other things were done that really can only be done in China. For instance, two dedicated hospitals were built in just over a week. Imagine that happening here.
Yeah.
Healthcare workers from all over China were transported into the area to try and help with the illness. So these are things that in a country like New Zealand, or even a much bigger country like America, these are things that can't really happen, just because of the nature of the countries.
Okay, we should probably move on to the next topic if that's all good. We're talking about a brightening star.
Yeah, so some people may have heard this. So this is, if you look in the sky and you look at the constellation Orion, the sort of the shoulder, the right shoulder of the constellation Orion is a star called Betelgeuse. I guess it's the left shoulder in New Zealand because everything's inverted. Mm. Betelgeuse is this big red giant star. It's normally one of the 10 brightest stars in the night sky, but in October last year, it started getting dimmer. By mid-February, it had lost more than two-thirds of its brightness.
That's considerable.
And you could sort of see that with the naked eye. But now it sort of seems to be recovering. And the reason this is interesting, it's puzzling, but it's interesting because... it's a relatively close star. It's only 700 light years away, which, you know, seems like a long way, but it's relatively close. It's a red supergiant, relatively cool, but it is a star that could, at some point, explode.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And
so this kind of changes, sets alarm bells? Or?
Well, not really alarm bells, but it's incredibly interesting if that were to happen. Mm. So Betelgeuse is only about 10 million years old, so it's much, much, much younger than the Sun. Mm. But its astronomers or astrophysicists have predicted that it will end in a big supernova explosion sometime in the next 100,000 years. That's, again, a long time, but when sort of weird things start happening, scientists don't really know what the precursor to that big bang would be. When weird things start happening, people start to speculate, well, maybe it's about to go.
Right.
Of course, it's 700 light years away, so maybe it was about to go actually 700 years ago. We're only just seeing it.
Okay.
But when it does go, when it does explode, it will be brighter than the full moon.
Wow.
Yeah, and visible during the day.
Wow. Okay.
Which is pretty cool. So everyone's hoping for a big, big explosion.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And our last topic.
All right.
Genomes of rats in New York.
Yeah. So this is about this is quite interesting. This is about how rats have been able to adapt to urban life. So rats in New York eat pizza, they eat hot dogs, they eat salads, they eat. They live everywhere in New York. They live in subway tunnels and playground sandpits and all over the place.
Sand yeah, pits.
It's pretty gross.
Whoa.
And there's estimated about 2 million rats in New York. Yeah.
2 million? How
right.
many people are in New York? Do we know?
Over 10, I think.
10.
I'm not sure.
That's a lot of rats.
It's a lot of rats. Yeah. Okay. You're never very far from a rat, okay. I think, if you're in New York. And so people were interested in, first of all, how can rats adapt so well to these? How come they can adapt so well to these sort of urban conditions? And so these researchers trapped a lot of rats and sequenced their genomes and looked for differences between the rats in New York, and these were brown rats, and the rats from rural northeast China, which is thought to be the home, the ancestral home of these, of these brown rats. And they looked for regions of the genome that contained variations that were likely to be beneficial for New York City rats. They found quite a few different gene variants, changes in the genome. They haven't really figured out exactly what it is that these genes are doing to make the rats, live better in New York or be able to adapt to New York.
Interesting.
Yeah, but so one example is a particular gene that may be important for detoxifying plant compounds, so maybe could help the city rats enjoy the kale salads that are left outside diners and things like that. But it's hard to say exactly what these genes are doing. But what I thought was interesting was they thought, okay, New York rats, well, probably any city in America would be the same. So the guy who was doing the research lived in Boston. So we tried to isolate some Boston rats. And they used the same trapping mechanisms, the same bait, pizza or whatever it was that they used for the New York rats. They didn't catch any rats.
Wow.
Because, and all the rat trappers will tell you, the Boston rats, they prefer Dunkin' Donuts pastries.
Okay.
And Slim Jim sort of sausages things. So the Boston rats have a different taste to the
different
New York rats.
Taste.
So they've adapted maybe in a slightly different way. So they haven't done the genome of those rats yet.
Right.
But, you know, subpopulation of Boston rats.
So this just means that, yeah, they've learned to live off the food that maybe is getting chucked in the ground or...
I guess that's right. Yeah, people eat pizza in New York and Dunkin' Donuts in Boston.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you so much, Marcus.
All right,
we can leave it there, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
See you then.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.